Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to KBOO, KBOO, 90.7 FM, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns in alignment with KBOO's mission, goals, and policies. The development director works closely with management and staff to identify funding priorities and create major donor campaigns, capital campaigns, and grant writing. More info can be found at kboo.fm/hiring. We will begin reviewing applications on August 7th, and the position will remain open until filled. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO Podcast, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review.
Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoint. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Frontline investigative reporter Arun Gupta on the sentencing of Trump's troops and how the prosecutor's stiffer sentencing recommendations have been generally rebuffed by the sentencing judges. And we present a dramatic reading of the Trump indictment for his attempt to steal the 2020 presidential elections. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Well, the word came down from the judge today, Enrique Tarrio, the former national chairman of the Proud Boys, convicted of seditious conspiracy, sentenced to 22 years. That goes along with the sentencing last week of Oath Keepers leader Stuart Rhodes. He got 18. Our guest, Arun Gupta. Generally speaking, Arun, you feel that both these sentences are not harsh enough? Or what's your general take on, remind us, by the way, who these folks are, and then your sense of the way in which the judges have been dealing with the recommendations from the prosecutors?
Sure. Let's start with who these people are. Enrique Tarrio was a national chairman of the Proud Boys. He is a former convicted criminal, not that that should matter, but he was also a snitch for the feds, and a lot of people would care about that. And so he's an Afro-Cuban, or at least that's what he says, from the Miami area, because I interviewed him a good bit about 5 years ago. And he's one of these essentially white nationalist men of color that are all throughout the far right, these extremist groups. And the reason I say, you know, he says he's Afro-Cuban, because I've talked to so many of them, and I did this piece on multiracial white supremacy that you can find in the Daily Beast. That was really one of the first pieces to look at this contradiction. And these guys, black, Latino, Asian, they would always talk of themselves as American, but the instant there were charges of racism, they would be like, oh, but I'm black. Oh, but I'm Mexican-American. Oh, but, you know, I'm from Japan. How could the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers or you know, whomever be racist? But that was their role, was to deflect racism. So he was essentially the leader of what is like a fascistic street gang. And for years, the media just basically repeated their propaganda. Oh, we're a drinking fraternity. We're a men's club. Even though they were heavily involved in the 2017 Charlottesville riot, I've identified 7 different Proud Boys who were involved in it. The guy who was a main organizer, Jason Kessler, was a Proud Boy, they denied and lied about him not being a Proud Boy. Then video surfaced of his inauguration. There was Augustus Invictus Saul, who is an outright neo-Nazi, Holocaust denier. He was the head of their Fraternal Order of Alt Knights, which is a fascist militia. And then Enrique Tarrio, you know, the Proud Boys denied that he was in Charlottesville, but except there were photos of him in Charlottesville. And so they participated in this, you know, this Unite the Right that brought together all these neo-Nazis, neo-Confederates, violent white nationalists, and that would ended with the murder of Heather Heyer by a neo-Nazi. And so the Proud Boys have always been basically this, they're the Trump's brown shirts is the simple way to describe them. But the media just corporate media just committed like complete journalistic malpractice in for years, basically giving them this veneer of like, oh, they're just like this, you know, kind of, you know, ironic political organization, even though they would repeatedly go to cities just to riot and to attack people. Another one of their leaders was Joseph Biggs. I interviewed him as well. He's an ex-military. He was, I believe, a sergeant in the U.S. Army. And it's also worth noting, of course, how many of the January 6th perpetrators, a huge portion of them, I think it's like 20-25% or something, maybe more, who were active duty military veterans or police officers. A lot of them currently sworn law enforcement officers. And so I interviewed Joseph Biggs as well. That was 2019, actually. And he was involved in basically whipping up just this violent atmosphere for this march in Portland that was supposed to happen that August. And I happened to be there that summer, and everyone was on edge, and they were expecting people to get killed. And Biggs was going on social media, posting images of weapons that he says he was going to use. Far-right extremists were posting lists of people who they were going to kill, graphic images of people being killed, you know, things like people being garroted, shot, and the government did nothing. Even though all of this is completely criminal terrorist threats, the government did nothing. I've also talked to Ethan Nordine only for a few minutes. He is basically a brawler. He's an enforcer. I've interviewed other enforcers who are now sitting in jail.
Remind us who he is. Remind us who he is.
He came to prominence again in Portland, and we have to remember, it keeps going back to Portland. Basically, January 6th would not have happened without Portland. Now, all over the country, police forces are historically sympathetic to far-right extremism, to white nationalism. You know, it's not just a slogan. Cops and Klan go hand in hand. There is a long history of this. All across the country, the far right would go to basically incite violence. And in most cities, they were able to commit violence, like in New York City, Seattle, Berkeley, but they weren't able to rampage freely. And the Portland police, they basically ignored them. They colluded with them. They collaborated in different ways. There was this one basically massive street riot by the Proud Boys in 2018, in June of 2018. And you can go to Twitter and find the videos where you see mobs just stomping people on the ground. And I talked to reporters. I was in the city covering Occupy ICE that was going on at the same time. And I talked to reporters who explained who they watched as the Portland police basically blockaded the anti-fascists, and then they marched the Proud Boys straight into them on the other side. So they essentially created a pincher move. And I was there, and I saw the same exact thing happen in 2019, where there was about 500 neo-fascist, Nazi, neo-Confederates. They had all these weapons in a park, even though it was completely illegal, and the police let them keep it, even though they were displaying them openly. And then I watched as they were lined up, and the police turned their backs to the far right, and they faced a crowd of about 1,200 anti-fascists who were just chanting peacefully, and unloaded weapons on them. They nearly killed two people with flashbang grenades. They then, after they fired off all these flashbangs, all these chemical weapons, then they charged the crowd. And what they did was they then let the far right into the city to then go attacking people. This was complete collusion. The police chief at the time, Daniel Outlaw, who's now working her fascist violence in Philadelphia, her fascist magic in Philadelphia, repeatedly claimed that anti-fascists, you know, were throwing things. There were hundreds of cell phones and cameras. No one recorded anything thrown until the police started unleashing all these lethal weapons on the crowd. So this is the culmination. So when we talk about these sentences, you know, that there has never been an instance that I can recall, and I've been asking people who are experts on this, of where the prosecutors again and again are asking for sentences that the judges reduce. And the things that the judges say are just completely absurd. So usually what you see is the judges will give them far more years. So in the case of Tarillo and Biggs, I both believe, both of them, and I think Stuart Rhodes of the Oath Keepers, they were all, prosecutors asked for 33-year sentences. Rhodes and Joseph Biggs got 18-year sentences, or Biggs, I think, got a 17-year sentence. Rio got a 22-year sentence. And yes, those are long sentences, but for them to come in so far below what the federal sentencing guidelines, you know, what the prosecutors are calling for as a minimum sentence is absurd. And I'll just point out one counter example. In 2010, there was a former Pakistani student in Brooklyn who was essentially being tortured by the federal government. He had been held for 3 years. He was not convicted of anything, in solitary confinement with 23-hour lockdowns, constant video surveillance, and almost no visitors. And we know that these type of conditions drive people completely insane. He eventually pled guilty to one charge, a material aid to Al-Qaeda, and was given a 15-year sentence. And what was his crime? He helped someone deliver socks and sleeping bags to Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. That's it. Meanwhile, you have these guys who nearly overthrew the U.S. government in a dead white nationalist coup, and then they're being given these sentences that are far below what the government is asking for. And the judges are saying things like, well, you know, the sentence isn't really up to, like, the terrorism charge. And then at the same time, they're calling this the gravest threat to U.S. democracy. And it's just like, I don't think that, you know, I think terrorism laws are political weapons, but this is a dictionary definition of terrorism, which is to use political violence to change the political and social order. It's exactly what they're doing is terrorism.
That's right. I want to, let me just jump in here for a moment and say we're speaking with Arun Gupta, a wonderful reporter, has covered the story of the extreme right wingers for years. He has written for The Intercept, Washington Post, The Nation, Raw Story, The Guardian, Jacoby. He's written for a lot of places about important things. He's been on this story. Today, as you say, Tarillo was sentenced to 22 years. You feel still it wasn't strong enough. He's an interesting player because he wasn't on the scene smashing windows. He was really sort of the intelligence of the operation, right?
Well, he was instigating them real time. He was telling them to take the building as they were assaulting it. He was recruiting people. He had previously been banned for D.C. because at another demonstration in the lead up to January 6th, a few weeks before, a Black Lives Matter flag was torn down from a church and he burned it. I mean, you know, he's basically like the Samuel L. Jackson character in Django Unchained. Like, you know, he's out there like defending the Confederacy to the last. Like, is this guy wants to claim he's not racist and he's burning a Black Lives Matter banner? You know, and I think we're also, you know, at least Pacifica listeners are, you know, understand that racism has nothing to do with the race. You know, and the reason these guys do it is pretty clear. And the thing, the reason I mentioned that Trujillo had a criminal background is so did Joey Gibson, the leader of Patriot Prayer. He had a criminal background. I think Joseph Biggs might have, you know, and what this is what the right does. This is what the Nazis did. They recorded, they recruited criminals for the brown shirts, right? People who weren't afraid to go out and commit violence for political ends. And for a lot of these guys, you know, they're basically all losers. And it's a way to get fame, to get money, to get celebrity. And so, yeah, they'll do the dirty work of white nationalism. There was also an incident where there was this, again, in Portland, where I was kind of goading this one woman. I'm trying to remember what her last name was. But I've written about it before. And because she was like white lives, she would say white lives matter. And she'd on social media and talk about Haley Adams, talk about curb stomping immigrants. And I was just like, you know, kind of goading her, like saying, hey, Haley, what about this? What about this? And she started ranting about, you know, it's just like, of course I'm for white people. And right beside her were Joey Gibson and Tusitala Tiny Toes, again, one of these huge enforcers, and they're trying to get her to shut up because they know this is a bad look. They knew exactly what they were doing, that they were being basically the brown faces for a violent white nationalist movement, and they're happy to do it because they think they're safe and they're going to, you know, be rewarded in all these different ways. But the real thing, the real problem is this is not going away. You know, what the whole Trump year showed was not just the failure of the police, the media, the political system. Of course, those all failed. But this is about the failure of the American project. You know, this country needs to be burned down to the ground in terms of its political and social structures. It is completely white nationalist, white supremacist to the core, because it is a good chance. It is a really good chance Donald Trump is going to be elected again in 2024, despite the insane chaos, because the Democrats are so corrupt, so bankrupt. So they're basically, at this point, I'm calling it cadaver capitalism and zombie empire. I mean, we are literally ruled by cadavers like Joe Biden, like Mitch McConnell, like Dianne Feinstein, Chuck Schumer, all the rest of them. They've completely run out of ideas, but the American state keeps going endlessly like a zombie, basically eating the brains of everyone in the world with the endless wars and endless fossil fuel extractivism.
Can I just jump in here and ask you, you are definitely the right person. We're going to go a little bit longer with you, and we're going to play our a good chunk of the reading of the indictment of Trump for the Washington stuff, but you know too much about all of this, Arun Gupta. The Attorney General of the United States waited a year to appoint a special prosecutor. That's one thing. All the different federal police forces are, generally speaking, racist and more racist. I mean, what percentage of the FBI, how many black FBI officers are there in the FBI? FBI, the DEA, wherever. You may remember I did a series of stories on what were called these old boy parties, where federal agents throughout the South would gather together and have these sort of, racist old boy parties, and they'd celebrate all the old stuff. You know, this was investigated by the Justice Department. Nothing ever happened. The racism is absolutely overwhelming. I mean, seriously, everybody, it's a big joke. If those were brown and black people hammering on the windows of the Capitol, there would have been a lot of dead bodies. So there is a big problem, isn't there?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, I would add to that another point. All we need to do is look in the international realm, right? How did the British Empire rule India? It did it with Indian troops who were enforcing just this absolutely vicious, racist, white nationalist, colonial state. And it was every bit as vicious as the Nazis. They just did not have the means that the Nazis did. It's estimated the British may have killed 200 to 300 million people in India alone over two centuries. That's what they did throughout Africa. That's what the French did. It's still going on all over the world. You know, in Guatemala during the genocide, the fascist state in the early 1980s, which the UN did label a genocide against the Mayans with 200,000 killed, the government was using Mayan recruits, indigenous recruits. They were going into villages in the highland. They would massacre the entire villages, like 1,000 people. They would do such barbaric things as throw babies in the air and catch them on bayonets. And I know that's a horrible thing, but, you know, this is what they were doing. They were using the indigenous against the indigenous, right? We see this all the time. So why is it so hard to believe that you could have these low-life clowns like Enrique Carrillo, like Stuart Rhodes, who's also, he's a half Mexican, like Joey Gibson, be the brown and black faces for violent white nationalism. This is the story of history itself. And yeah, we see it all throughout American history. You know, the police basically had two origins. One was as it started with the Pinkertons as this force to suppress immigrant labor, and it especially tended to be from South Europe, right? So they were very racialized up until the mid-20th century to violently suppress labor activism. And the second origin was the slave catchers during the antebellum era. And so racism is completely baked into police forces.
Amazing. All right, listen. We appreciate all the great work you always do. You're wonderful. We love to have you on, Arun. You're the kind of journalist we get to, like, dig into your notebook. We know there's always more in there and plenty to get out. And we're happy that you'll share your thoughts and your research with us, as you've been really on top of this issue. And we ain't seen, you know, it really could go that way of Trump, and this could get still extraordinarily worse. Is that a phrase? Anyway, what we've done here, Arun, and I want to let people, please tell us what you think. Some of you may not be crazy about reading documents, but we thought, since so little attention was paid to this Trump document, since the sentencing was happening today, so we wanted to share the Trump indictment, the insurrection one. They didn't charge him with insurrection, but we got a little help in terms of reading. And let's just say this is the story of an historic indictment filled with crime, deceit, coercion, and collusion. This is how a team of crooks attempted to cheat an entire nation while exposing the strength and weaknesses of our democracy and electoral process. And Donald J. Trump, failed mastermind, faces the charges against him. Here they are. The Indictment of Donald J. Trump, Part 1.
The Indictment of Donald J. Trump, Defendant. Count 1, conspiracy to defraud the United States. Count 2, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding. Count 3, obstruction of an attempt to obstruct an official proceeding. Count 4, conspiracy against rights. Introduction. The defendant, Donald J. Trump, was the 45th president of the United States and a candidate for re-election in 2020. The defendant lost the 2020 presidential election. Despite having lost, the defendant was determined to remain in power. So for more than 2 months following Election Day on November 3rd, 2020, the defendant spread lies that there had been outcome determinative fraud in the election and that he had actually won. These claims were false, and the defendant knew that they were false. But the defendant repeated and widely disseminated them anyway to make his knowingly false claims appear legitimate, create an intense national atmosphere of mistrust and anger, and erode public faith in the administration of the election. The defendant had a right, like every American, to speak publicly about the election and to even claim falsely that there had been outcome determinative fraud during the election and that he had won. He was also entitled to formally challenge the results of the election through lawful and appropriate means, such as by seeking recounts or audits of the popular votes in states, or filing lawsuits challenging ballots and procedures. Indeed, in many cases, the defendant did pursue these methods of contesting the election results. His efforts to change the outcome in any state through recounts, audits, or legal challenges were uniformly unsuccessful. Shortly after Election Day, the defendant also pursued unlawful means of discounting legitimate votes and subverting the election results. In doing so, the defendant perpetrated 3 criminal conspiracies. A conspiracy to defraud the United States by using dishonesty, fraud, and deceit to impair, obstruct, and defeat the lawful federal government function by which the results of the presidential election are collected, counted, and certified by the federal government in violation of 18 U.S. Code 371. A conspiracy to corruptly obstruct and impede the January 6th congressional proceeding by which the collected results of the presidential election are counted and certified, the certification proceeding, in violation of 18 U.S. Code 1512. And a conspiracy against the right to vote and have one's vote counted, in violation of 18 U.S. Code 241. Each of these conspiracies, which built on the widespread mistrust the defendant was creating through pervasive and destabilizing lies about election fraud, targeted a bedrock function of the United States federal government, the nation's process of collecting, counting, and certifying the results of the presidential election, the federal government function. Count 1, conspiracy to defraud the United States. From on or about November 14th, 2020, through on or about January 20th, 2021, in the District of Columbia and elsewhere, the defendant, Donald J. Trump, did knowingly combine, conspire, confederate, and agree with co-conspirators, known and unknown to the grand jury, to defraud the United States by using dishonesty, fraud, and deceit to impair, obstruct, and defeat the lawful federal government function by which the results of the presidential election are collected, counted, and certified by the federal government. The purpose of the conspiracy was to overturn the legitimate results of the 2020 presidential election by using knowingly false claims of election fraud to obstruct the federal government function by which those results are collected, counted, and certified. The defendant's co-conspirators. The defendant enlisted co-conspirators to assist him in his criminal efforts to overturn the legitimate results of the 2020 presidential election and retain power. Among these were co-conspirator 1, an attorney who was willing to spread knowingly false claims and pursue strategies that the defendant's 2020 re-election campaign attorneys would not. Co-conspirator 2, an attorney who devised and attempted to implement a strategy to leverage the vice president's ceremonial role overseeing the certification proceeding to obstruct the certification of the presidential election. Co-conspirator 3, an attorney whose unfounded claims of election fraud the defendant privately acknowledged to others sounded, quote, crazy. Nonetheless, the defendant embraced and publicly amplified co-conspirator 3's disinformation. Co-conspirator 4, a Justice Department official who worked on civil matters and who, with the defendant, attempted to use the Justice Department to open sham election crime investigations and influence state legislatures with knowingly false claims of election fraud. Co-conspirator 5, an attorney who assisted in devising and attempting to implement a plan to submit fraudulent slates of presidential electors to obstruct the certification proceeding. Co-conspirator 6, a political consultant who helped implement a plan to submit fraudulent slates of presidential electors to obstruct the certification proceeding. The federal government function. The federal government function by which the results of the election for President of the United States are collected, counted, and certified was established through the Constitution and the Electoral Count Act, ECA, a federal law enacted in 1887. The Constitution provided that individuals called electors select the president and that each state determine for itself how to appoint the electors apportioned to it. Through state laws, each of the 50 states and the District of Columbia chose to select their electors based on the popular vote in the state. After Election Day, the ECA required each state to formally determine or ascertain the electors who would represent the state's voters by casting electoral votes on behalf of the candidate who had won the popular vote, and required the executive of each state to certify to the federal government the identities of those electors. Then on a date set by the ECA, each state's ascertained electors were required to meet and collect the results of the presidential election. That is, to cast electoral votes based on their state's popular vote and to send their electoral votes along with the state executive certification that they were the state's legitimate electors to the United States Congress to be counted and certified in an official proceeding. Finally, the Constitution and ECA required that on the 6th of January following Election Day, the Congress meet in a joint session for a certification proceeding presided over by the Vice President as President of the Senate to count the electoral votes, resolve any objections, and announce the result, thus certifying the winner of the presidential election as presidential elect. The federal government function, from the point of ascertainment to the certification, is foundational to the United States democratic process. And until 2021, it operated in a peaceful and orderly manner for more than 130 years. Manner and means. The defendant's conspiracy to impair, obstruct, and defeat the federal government function through dishonesty, fraud, and deceit, including the following manner and means. The defendant and co-conspirators used knowingly false claims of election fraud to get state legislators and election officials to subvert the legitimate election results and change electoral votes for the defendant's opponent, Joseph R. Biden Jr., to electoral votes for the defendant. That is, on the pretext of baseless fraud claims, the defendant pushed officials in certain states to ignore the popular vote, disenfranchise millions of voters, dismiss legitimate electors, and ultimately cause the ascertainment of and voting by illegitimate electors in favor of the defendant. The defendant and co-conspirators organized fraudulent slates of electors in 7 targeted states: Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, attempting to mimic the procedures that the legitimate electors were supposed to follow under the Constitution and other federal and state laws. This included causing the fraudulent fraudulent electors to meet on the day appointed by federal law on which legitimate electors were to gather and cast their votes, cast fraudulent votes for the defendant, and sign certificates falsely representing that they were legitimate electors. Some fraudulent electors were tricked into participating based on the understanding that their votes would be used only if the defendant succeeded in outcome determinative lawsuits within their state, which the defendant never did. The defendant and co-conspirators then caused these fraudulent electors to transmit their false certificates to the vice president and other government officials to be counted at the certification proceeding on January 6th. The defendant and co-conspirators attempted to use the power and authority of the Justice Department to conduct sham election crime investigations and to send a letter to the targeted states that falsely claimed that the Justice Department had identified significant concerns that may have impacted the election outcome. They sought to advance the defendant's fraudulent elector plan by using the Justice Department's authority to falsely present the fraudulent electors as a valid alternative to the legitimate electors. And that urged, on behalf of the Justice Department, the targeted states' legislatures to convene to create the opportunity to choose the fraudulent electors over the legitimate electors. The defendant and co-conspirators attempted to enlist the vice president to use his ceremonial role at the January 6th certification proceeding to fraudulently alter the election results. First, using knowingly false claims of election fraud, the defendant and co-conspirators attempted to convince the vice president to use the defendant's fraudulent electors, reject legitimate electoral votes, or send legitimate electoral votes to state legislatures for review rather than counting them. When that failed, on the morning of January 6th, the defendant and co-conspirators repeated knowingly false claims of election fraud to gathered supporters, falsely told them that the vice president had the authority to and might alter the election results, and directed them to the Capitol to obstruct the certification proceeding and exert pressure on the vice president to take the fraudulent actions that he had previously refused. After it became public on the afternoon of January 6th that the vice president would not fraudulently alter the election results, a large and angry crowd, including many individuals who the defendant had deceived into believing the vice president could and might change the election results, violently attacked the Capitol and halted the proceedings. As violence ensued, the defendant and co-conspirators exploited the disruption by redoubling efforts to levy false claims of election fraud and convince members of Congress to further delay the certification based on those claims. The defendant's knowledge of the falsity of his election fraud claims. The defendants, his co-conspirators, and their agents made knowingly false claims that there had been outcome determinative fraud in the 2020 presidential election. These prolific lies about election fraud, including dozens of specific claims that there had been substantial fraud in certain states, such as a large number of dead, non-resident, non-citizen, or otherwise ineligible voters had cast ballots, or that voting machines had changed votes for the defendant to votes for Biden. These claims were false, and the defendant knew that they were false. In fact, the defendant was notified repeatedly that his claims were untrue, often by the people on whom he relied for candid advice on important matters and who were best positioned to know the facts, and he deliberately disregarded the truth. For instance, the defendant's vice president, who personally stood to gain by remaining in office as part of the defendant's ticket, and whom the defendant asked to study fraud allegations, told the defendant that he had seen no evidence of outcome determinative fraud. Senior leaders of the Justice Department, appointed by the defendant and responsible for investigating credible allegations of election crimes, told the defendant on multiple occasions that various allegations of fraud were unsupported. The Director of National Intelligence, the defendant's principal advisor on intelligence matters related to national security, disabused the defendant of the notion that the intelligence community's findings regarding foreign interference would change the outcome of the election. The Department of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, whose existence the defendant signed into law to protect the nation's cybersecurity infrastructure from attack, joined an official multi-agency statement that there was no evidence in any voting system had been compromised. And that declared the 2020 election, quote, the most secure in American history. Days later, after the CISA director, whom the defendant had appointed, announced publicly that election security experts were in agreement that claims of computer-based election fraud were unsubstantiated, the defendant fired him. Senior White House attorneys selected by the defendant to provide him candid advice informed the defendant that there was no evidence of outcome determinative election fraud and told him that his presidency would end on Inauguration Day in 2021. Senior staffers on the defendant's 2020 re-election campaign, whose sole mission was the defendant's re-election, told the defendant on November 7th, 2020, that he had only 5 to 10% chance of prevailing in the election, and that success was contingent on the defendant winning ongoing vote counts or litigation in Arizona, Georgia, and Wisconsin. Within a week of that assessment, the defendant lost in Arizona, meaning he had lost the election. State legislators and officials, many of whom were the defendant's political allies, had voted for him and wanted him to be reelected, repeatedly informed the defendant that his claims of fraud in their states were unsubstantiated or false, and resisted his pressure to act based upon them. State and federal courts, the neutral arbiters responsible for ensuring the fair and even-handed administration of election laws, rejected every outcome determinative post-election lawsuit filed by the defendant, his co-conspirators, and allies, providing the defendant real-time notice that his allegations were meritless. The defendant widely disseminated his false claims of election fraud for months, despite the fact that he knew and in many cases had been informed directly that they were not true. The defendant's knowingly false statements were integral to his criminal plans to defeat the federal government's function, obstruct the certification, and interfere with others' right to vote and have their votes counted. He made these knowingly false claims throughout the post-election time period, including those below that he made immediately before the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. The defendant insinuated that more than 10,000 dead voters had voted in Georgia. Just 4 days earlier, Georgia's Secretary of State had explained to the defendant that this was false. The defendant asserted that there had been 205,000 more votes than voters in Pennsylvania. The defendant's acting attorney general and acting deputy attorney general had explained to him that this was false. The defendant said that there had been a suspicious vote dump in Detroit, Michigan. The defendant's attorney general had explained to the defendant that this was false, and the defendant's allies in the Michigan state legislature, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and the majority leader of the Senate had publicly announced that there was no evidence of substantial fraud in the state. The defendant claimed that there had been tens of thousands of double votes and other fraud in Nevada. The Nevada Secretary of State had previously rebutted the defendant's fraud claims by publicly posting a, quote, facts versus myth document explaining the Nevada judges had reviewed and rejected them. And the Nevada Supreme Court had rendered a decision denying such claims. The defendant said that more than 30,000 non-citizens had voted in Arizona. The defendant's own campaign manager had explained to him that such claims were false. And the Speaker of the Arizona House of Representatives, who had supported the defendant in the election, had issued a public statement that there was no evidence of substantial fraud in Arizona. The defendant asserted that voting machines in various contested states had switched votes from the defendant to Biden. The defendant's attorney general, acting attorney general, and the acting deputy attorney general all had explained to him that this was false, and numerous recounts and audits had confirmed the accuracy of voting machines. The criminal agreement and acts to effect the object of conspiracy. The defendant's use of deceit to get state officials to subvert the legitimate election results and change electoral votes. Shortly after Election Day, which fell on November 3rd, 2020, the defendant launched his criminal scheme. On November 13th, the defendant's campaign attorneys conceded in court that he had lost the vote count in the state of Arizona, meaning, based on the assessment the defendant's campaign advisors had given him just a week earlier, the defendant had lost the election. So the next day, the defendant turned to co-conspirator Wong, whom he announced would spearhead his efforts going forward to challenge the election results. From that point on, the defendant and his co-conspirators executed a strategy to use knowing deceit in the targeted states to impair, obstruct, and defeat the federal government function, including as described below. Arizona. On November 13, 2020, the defendant had a conversation with his campaign manager, who informed him that a claim that had been circulating that a substantial number of non-citizens had voted in Arizona was false. On November 22nd, 8 days before Arizona's governor certified the ascertainment of the state's legitimate electors based on the popular vote, the defendant and co-conspirator one called the Speaker of the Arizona House of Representatives and made knowingly false claims of election fraud aimed at interfering with the ascertainment of and voting by Arizona's electors as follows. The defendant and co-conspirator one falsely asserted, among other things, that a substantial number of non-citizens, non-residents, and dead people had voted fraudulently in Arizona. The Arizona House Speaker asked co-conspirator one for evidence of the claims, which co-conspirator one did not have, but claimed he would provide. Co-conspirator one never did so. The defendant and co-conspirator one asked the Arizona House Speaker to call the legislature into session to hold a hearing based on their claims of election fraud. The Arizona House Speaker refused, stating that doing so would require a two-thirds vote of its members, and he would not allow it without actual evidence of fraud. The defendant and co-conspirator one asked the Arizona House Speaker to use the legislature to circumvent the process by which legitimate electors would be ascertained for Biden based on the popular vote and replace those electors with a new slate for the defendant. The Arizona House Speaker refused, responding that the suggestion was beyond anything that he had ever heard or thought of as something within his authority. On December 1st, co-conspirator one met with the Arizona House Speaker. When the Arizona House Speaker again asked co-conspirator one for evidence of the outcome determinative election fraud he and the defendant had been claiming, co-conspirator one responded with words to the effect of, quote, "We don't have the evidence, but we have lots of theories." On December 4th, the Arizona House Speaker issued a public statement that said, in part, "No election is perfect, and if there were evidence of illegal votes or an improper count, then Arizona law provides a process to contest the election, a lawsuit under state law. But the law does not authorize the legislature to reverse the results of an election. As a conservative Republican, I don't like the results of the presidential election. I voted for President Trump and worked hard to reelect him, but I cannot and will not entertain a suggestion that we violate current law to change the outcome of a certified election. I and my fellow legislators swore an oath to support the U.S. Constitution and the Constitution and laws of the state of Arizona. It would violate that oath, the basic principles of Republican government, and the rule of law if we attempted to nullify the people's vote based on unsupported theories of fraud. Under the laws that we wrote and voted upon, Arizona voters choose who wins, and our system requires that their choice be respected." On the morning of January 4th, 2021, Co-conspirator 2 called the Arizona House Speaker to urge him to use a majority of the legislature to decertify the state's legitimate electors. Arizona's validly ascertained electors had voted 3 weeks earlier and sent their votes to Congress, which was scheduled to count those votes in Biden's favor in just 2 days' time at the January 6th certification proceeding. When the Arizona House Speaker explained that the state investigations had uncovered no evidence of substantial fraud in the state, co-conspirator conceded that he didn't, quote, "know enough about the facts on the ground in Arizona," but nonetheless told the Arizona House Speaker to decertify and, quote, "let the court sort it out." The Arizona House Speaker refused, stating that he would not, quote, "play with the oath he had taken to uphold the United States Constitution and Arizona law." On January 6th, the defendant publicly repeated the knowingly false claim that 36,000 non-citizens had voted in Georgia. Georgia. On November 16th, 2020, on the defendant's behalf, His executive assistant sent co-conspirator 3 and others a document containing bullet points critical of a certain voting machine company, writing, quote, see attached. Please include as is or almost as is in a lawsuit. Co-conspirator 3 responded 9 minutes later, writing in all caps, it must go in all suits in Georgia and Pennsylvania immediately with a fraud claim that requires the entire election to be set aside in those states and machines impounded for nonpartisan, professional inspection. On November 25th, co-conspirator 3 filed a lawsuit against the Georgia governor, falsely alleging massive election fraud accomplished through the voting machine company's election software and hardware. Before the lawsuit was even filed, the defendant retweeted a post promoting it. The defendant did this despite the fact that when he had discussed co-conspirator 3's far-fetched public claim regarding the voting machine company in private with advisors, the defendant had conceded that they were unsupported and that co-conspirator 3 sounded, quote, crazy. Co-conspirator 3's Georgia lawsuit was dismissed on December 7th. On December 3rd, co-conspirator 1 orchestrated a presentation to a judiciary subcommittee of the Georgia State Senate with the intention of misleading the state senators into blocking the ascertainment of legitimate electors during the presentation. An agent of the defendant and co-conspirator 1 falsely claimed that more than 10,000 dead people voted in Georgia. That afternoon, a senior advisor to the defendant told the defendant's chief of staff through text messages, quote, just an FYI, a campaign lawyer and his team verified that 10,000 supposed dead people voting in Georgia is not accurate. It was alleged in co-conspirator 1's hearing today. The senior advisor clarified that he believed that the actual number was 12. Another agent of the defendant and co-conspirator 1 played a misleading excerpt of a video recording of ballot counting at a State Farm arena in Atlanta and insinuated that it showed election workers counting, quote, suitcases of illegal ballots. Co-conspirator 2 encouraged the legislators to decertify the state legitimate electors based on false allegations of election fraud. On December 3rd, the defendant issued a tweet amplifying the knowingly false claims made in co-conspirator 1's presentation in Georgia. Quote, wow, blockbuster testimony taking place right now in Georgia. Ballot stuffing by Dems when Republicans were forced to leave the counting room. Plenty more coming, but this alone leads to an easy win of the state. On December 4th, Georgia's Secretary of State Chief Operating Officer debunked the claims made at co-conspirator 1's presentation the previous day, issuing a tweet stating, quote, a 90-second video of election workers at State Farm Arena purporting to show fraud was watched in its entirety by Georgia Secretary of State investigators. Shows normal ballot processing. Here's the fact check on it. On December 7th, he reiterated during a press conference that the claim that there had been misconduct at State Farm Arena was false. On December 8th, the defendant called the Georgia Attorney General to pressure him to support an election lawsuit filed in the Supreme Court by another state's attorney general. The Georgia Attorney General told the defendant that officials had investigated various claims of election fraud in the state and were not seeing any evidence to support them. Also on December 8th, a senior campaign advisor who spoke with the defendant on a daily basis and had informed him on multiple occasions that the various fraud claims were untrue, expressed frustration that many of the co-conspirator 1 and his legal teams could not be substantiated. As early as mid-November, for instance, the senior campaign advisor had informed the defendant that his claims of a large number of dead voters in Georgia were untrue. With respect to the persistent false claim regarding State Farm Arena on December 8th, the senior campaign advisor wrote in an email, quote, when our research and campaign legal team can't back up any of the claims made by our elite strike force legal team, you can see why we're 0-32 on our case. I'll obviously hustle to help on all fronts, but it's tough to own any of this when it's all just conspiracy beamed down from the mothership. On December 10th, 4 days before Biden's validly ascertained electors were scheduled to cast votes and send them to Congress, co-conspirator 1 appeared at a hearing before the Georgia House of Representatives Government's Affairs Committee. Co-conspirator 1 played the State Farm Arena video again and falsely claimed that it showed, quote, voter fraud right in front of people's eyes and was, quote, tip of the iceberg. Then he cited two election workers by name, baselessly accused them of quite obviously, surreptitiously, passing around USB ports as if they were vials of heroin or cocaine, and suggested that they were criminals whose, quote, places of work, their homes, should have been searched for evidence of ballots, for evidence of USB ports, for evidence of voter fraud. Thereafter, the two election workers received numerous death threats. On December 15th, the defendant summoned the incoming acting attorney general and incoming acting deputy attorney general and others to the Oval Office to discuss allegations of election fraud. During the meeting, the Justice Department's officials specifically refuted the defendant's claim about State Farm Arena, explaining to him that the activity shown on the tape co-conspirator one had used was, quote, benign. On December 23rd, a day after the defendant's chief of staff personally observed the signature verification process at the Cobb County Civic Center and notified the defendant that the state election officials were, quote, conducting themselves in an exemplary fashion and would find fraud if it existed, the defendant tweeted that the Georgia officials administrating the signature verification process were trying to hide evidence of election fraud and were, quote, terrible people. In a phone call on December 27th, the defendant spoke with the acting attorney general and the acting deputy attorney general. During the call, the defendant again pressed the unfounded claims regarding State Farm Arena, and the two top Justice Department officials again rebutted the allegations, telling him that the Justice Department had reviewed videotape and interviewed witnesses and had not identified any suspicious conduct. On December 31st, the defendant signed a verification affirming false election fraud allegations made on his behalf in a lawsuit filed in his name against the Georgia governor. In advance of the filing, co-conspirator 2, who was advising the defendant on the lawsuit, acknowledged in an email that he and the defendant had, since signing a previous verification, quote, been made aware that some of the allegations and evidence proffered by the experts has been inaccurate, and that signing a new affirmation, quote, with that knowledge and incorporation by reference would not be accurate. The defendant and co-conspirator 2 caused the defendant's signed verification to be filed nonetheless. On January 2nd, 4 days before Congress's certification proceeding, the defendant and others called Georgia's Secretary of State. During the call, the defendant lied to the Georgia Secretary of State to induce him to alter Georgia's popular vote count and call into question the validity of the Biden electors' votes, which had been transmitted to Congress weeks before, including as follows. The defendant raised allegations regarding the State Farm Arena video and repeatedly disparaged one of the same election workers that co-conspirator 1 had maligned on December 10th, using her name almost 20 times and falsely referring to her as, quote, a professional vote scammer and hustler. In response, the Georgia Secretary of State refuted this, quote, you're talking about the State Farm video, and I think that it's extremely unfortunate that co-conspirator 1 or his people, they slice and dice that video and took it out of context. When the Georgia Secretary of State then offered a link to a video that would disprove co-conspirator 1's claim, the defendant responded, quote, I don't care about a link. I don't need it. Georgia Secretary of State, I have a much better link. The defendant asked about rumors that paper ballots cast in the election were being destroyed, and the Georgia Secretary of State's counsel explained to him that the claim had been investigated and was not true. The defendant claimed that 5,000 dead people voted in Georgia, causing Georgia Secretary of State to respond, quote, well, Mr. President, the challenge that you have is the data you have is wrong. The actual number were two people that were dead that voted. And so your information's wrong. That was two. The defendant claimed that thousands of out-of-state voters had cast ballots in Georgia's election, which the Georgia Secretary of State's counsel refuted, explaining, quote, we've been going through each of those as well. And those numbers that we got, that the defendant's counsel was just saying, they're not accurate. Everyone we've been through are people that lived in Georgia, moved to a different state, but then moved back to Georgia legitimately. They moved back in years ago. This was not like something just before the election. In response to multiple other of the defendant's allegations, the Georgia Secretary of State's counsel told the defendant that the Georgia Bureau of Investigations was examining all such claims and finding no merit to them. The defendant said that he needed to, quote, find 11,780 votes and insinuated that the Georgia Secretary of State and his counsel could be subject to criminal prosecution if they failed to find election fraud, as he demanded, stating, quote, "And you are going to find that they are," which is totally illegal. It's more illegal for you than it is for them, because you know what they did and you're not reporting it. That's criminal, you know. That's a criminal offense. And, you know, you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to the Georgia Secretary of State's counsel, your lawyer. The next day, January 3rd, the defendant falsely claimed that the Georgia Secretary of State had not addressed the defendant's allegations publicly, stating that the Georgia Secretary of State, quote, was unwilling or unable to answer questions such as, quote, ballots under the table scam, ballots destruction, out-of-state voters, dead voters, and more. He has no clue. On January 6th, the defendant publicly repeated a knowingly false insinuation that more than 10,300 dead people had voted in Georgia.
And to hear the full versions of these parts, just log into flashpoints.net later in the week, as both will be posted. Thank you for listening.